open the Senate Revenue Committee for, what is today? The 27th of January. Used to be the Super Bowl would be played around this time, and now it like is
2 weeks out.
Like into February. They'll be playing it in like spring break by the time. Today we have Senate Bill 11, and then we're going to have one of our final orientations on the corporate income tax. Liz Beth is here to do that. But first and foremost, we have a group in. Senator Nelson was a key player, the key player in Senate Bill 622, and we're going to hear Senate Bill 11, who's also sponsored by Senator Nelson, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 11. Dr. Warner.
Mr. Chair, the original 622, I believe, passed in 2001, so this bill proposes some modifications to that original program.
Senator Nelson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your courtesy and schedule this meeting. The many of these people on this committee come a great distance, and the fact that they're down here for other hearings and other meetings is, and for you to fit them in, I really do appreciate that, and thank you. A little history. I have in front of you here the old schematic of the telecommunication infrastructure in the state of Oregon before 1999. It's right in front of me. It's all the straight lines. In 1999, we passed Senate Bill 622, and one of the things I've handed out to you is there's a map now. This is the top picture is the interlocking rings. I always refer them to the Olympic rings, but they're kind of roughly irregular, so they're really not there. They're not really truly Olympic rings, but they have the same concept. So we have redundancy, and this was 622 is really result of a public-private partnership. We changed some of the regulations for the four big telcos in the state, US West at that time, Sprint, Verizon, and General Tel. And they had an option to opt in. Well, only one of the four did, US West opt in exchange for a type of regulation from rules of regulatory type of regulation to price cap regulation. They came up with $120 million, and they basically built this system. A lot of it was already in existence, as you can tell by this thing in front, but they've just made it connected, and so it was interlocking. There's redundancy, high speed, that type of thing. The second picture on your thing is actually a NOAANet, and that's another communication system that has developed since 622. And you notice it fills in some of the spaces. The 622, as you notice, there are certain parts of the states that it did not cover. You know, basically the four corners. And the one around Hood River, that was the Sprint area. It basically took what the U.S. West territory at that time, now Quest. But the lower picture shows you the NOAANet network. It's only one of several networks out there that are bringing telecommunications access to people. The important thing here is that, you know, 622 started this. There's been other things happening. This is by no means the complete diagram of what we have services in the state of Oregon. And basically, we have state-of-the-art. We're probably number one in the nation as far as connecting the entire state with high-speed broadband access. What 622 didn't do, it didn't do the last mile. And so a lot of what we're talking about today is, okay, how do you put this out? We're talking about an investment tax credit today and, you know, trying to give people incentives to go out and do, and you know, give people greater access, get that access out to the last mile. What we found was that the previous bill that we passed in 2001, as Mr. Warner indicated, is really not much of an incentive. And so what Senate Bill 11 does, it comes in and does adds some carry-forward provisions and some transfer certificates so this thing may become more workable. Presently, I don't know what the fiscal impact will be, but I know the Senate President referred to this committee because there's potentially going to be some. And so, I mean, that's something that if you guys consider this, that's something we'll have to look at. But one other fact I did want to bring out is this Senate Bill 11 is really the result of a series of bills, starting with Senate Bill 11 through Senate Bill 16. It was brought to my attention. I chaired the interim committee on transportation, and, or not on transportation, on telecommunications, a joint committee. And this group that brought this forward is called the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. They were created in the last session under House Bill 2577. And it's a statewide network. The importance of this group is they're basically a statewide network. They're a consumer group, basically. They're trying to provide access. They work with the telecoms, the big boys. Sometimes they do agree with them. Sometimes they disagree with them. But they are a pushing force. They are somebody that's saying, okay, this is what we really need. And not looking at it from a business standpoint or consumer standpoint, but just how is it going to affect the state? What is the best thing that we can possibly do here? So, I mean, they have people from Central Oregon, the coast, the Eastern Oregon, Fiber South, the Frontier Network, the Gorge Teleconsortium, Regional Fiber Consortium, North Coast, South Coast, Southern Oregon, and there's two member the counties are involved in this particular thing. It's the importance of this group is the fact they create some energy and saying, okay, this is what we really need. Mm-hmm. And sometimes telecoms disagree with them, and I think you may get some testimony that they're saying that, well, the telecoms don't like this group, but really they're a very important group, and I think it's something we should continue to have involved in this. I call them rascally sometimes because they bring all sorts of some ideas, and they put them all on the table, and they talk them out, and they say, okay, this is good, this is bad. As a result of what they did this session, they came back to our Joint Interim Committee on Technology and brought forth these, I think, six bills. Senate Bill 11 is one of those. And I think there's some people in the back that probably know more about the actual workings of this, and I think it's time for them probably to step forward and come up and discuss and give you the intimate details of how this thing really does work. I don't know, is there somebody back there? That's
you're not going to get out that easy. Sir.
Okay. What do you?
Especially, you know, the little plaque in front of you there says Legislative Revenue Staff. So
we already know everything.
That invites us.
More power.
That invites us to ask many questions of technical nature.
Okay.
Questions for Senator Nelson. Senator George.
Senator Nelson, the governor talked in his State of the State speech about a concept of Connect Oregon, and we know it's mainly transportation. Is any part of that, this very critical aspect of communication infrastructure? Have you? Because I know it's pretty vague. We've asked questions about what is that? What are they doing?
Well, I mean,
if infrastructure is part of it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator George, the telecommunication infrastructure is... it is the infrastructure. I mean, I know if people come in for business, they ask about your schools, about your roads, and what is your high-speed access. In order for us to push out, I think, for the development and throughout the state, this is a very crucial part. I mean, we have a great system going. I mean, if you look at this map, I mean, basically we have the whole state covered. Everybody in the state can get high-speed bandwidth practically. There may be 5 or 10% that can't. But right now you can get all that. In my part of the country, LeGrand, where a lot of these people are based and where this whole thing came out of, basically in 622, we have Oregon Dental Service has a call set out there. And the reason they can do it is because they have a high-speed network. We have a connection with the Eastern Oregon University out there that basically is connected with Oregon Health Science University. So it's all connected, and it's really a major part of the infrastructure. I think the importance of this board, this council, is the fact that they are looking at that bigger picture. You know, it's not a profit and loss thing for them. It's, you know, it's not the telecoms. It's saying what is going to be best for the state of Oregon. So I appreciate your question.
And Senator Nelson, in some ways that was the question that I had is, you know, given that it's been 4 years since 622 passed, what has been your experience? I remember the conversation around it and being a part of the work group of how this would affect economic development, and it's actually good to revisit this and learn just what your experience has been in LeGrand and Pendleton with 622 and the broadband.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's been a statewide experience, and as you know, I think in the 2001 session you did the Oregon Opportunity with Oregon Health Science University, University of Oregon, Oregon State, telecommunication, what was that, telecommunication transfer?
Tech transfer.
Yeah, tech transfer. Yeah. So the universities, they could do the research.
Commercialize. Yeah.
And then actually develop products out of it. And that's been very successful. I think the University of Oregon has really made a big, big progress on it. So, I mean, this is a success story for the state of Oregon. And what we're trying to do with this bill and this other bill is, you know, we're trying to push the envelope a little more. Let's keep pushing this. Let's keep building this out. Let's continue to make this grow because the technology is changing. You know, I don't tell you folks anything different there. You know, what we were doing in 1999, it's a whole new set of technology. You know, is it going to be end of wireless, or is it going to be just the DSL with the wire? Is it going to be cable, or is it going to be something else that's going to come along? I think we're still in that process. Another point maybe I should bring up is that the connectivity that we have with the PUC. Several of the other bills are connected with the PUC. They are affected by what the federal communications, what is it, FCC, federal, what is it, Federal Communications
Commission
does. Well, they've just had a change in their chair. Chairman Powell has just stepped down. And so when I've talked with Lee Meyer, who is the commissioner, or the chair of the commission here at the PUC, he's saying, you know, some of these things we should be looking at very closely and perhaps doing, but we also need to be studying this because we're operating under a system of laws that was brought forth under a monopoly. That's all changed now. I mean, in a lot of respects, Oregon, you know, Quest now has probably the lion's share, but the technology is changing, and they may not be the major player as we come down in this, and so we need to look at that. But this is all part of this. This is a success story, you know, and what I'm asking is just consider this very, very seriously and, you know, see if there's something that we can do. And, you know, I understand there's budget constraints. So let's look at all these things and see what we can do. Have the conversation.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Okay.
Mr. Christopher Tamarillin?
Tamarillin.
Ms. Catherine Britton and Mr. Bill Penhollow.
And what I forgot to do is the Oregon Department of Economic Development and Community Development is also involved. And so Chris is involved with that and has been very, very helpful with it. So thank you, folks. You guys can take care of all of this without me, can't you?
I don't know.
You always have.
We wouldn't have made it without the board there.
Are you going to take your...
You want to bring your board home?
I have another committee meeting, so I'm just going to leave it here.
Okay.
Dave, seriously, why don't you leave it right there? Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'll bring it back up to your office. If you want to leave it right
there. I have another committee meeting.
Oh, just going to... Oh, okay.
It's traveling with the board.
In whatever order you choose, just give us your name.
First? And I guess I'm on first. For the record, my name is Catherine Britton. I am the director of Eastern Oregon Telecommunications Consortium. I sit on the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. I chair the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. And as you can see, I'm up to my ears in telecommunications. The Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council is bringing you this bill as an opportunity to correct, as David mentioned, or excuse me, Senator Nelson mentioned earlier, Senate Bill 229, which developed this tax credit but did not get the appropriate numbers in terms of cap and percentage into it to create an incentive. And when we talk about an incentive, one of the things that is really important in rural Oregon is enabling people, providers, to invest in telecommunications without taking extraordinary risks. And basically, we have very few companies at this point who are willing to take those extraordinary risks. They're not big enough. They don't have extensive enough capital to take the chance that they are going to bring the market in that they need to make a profit. We were charged by JLCIMT to look at ways that we could, innovative ways that we could actually get broadband out to rural areas. And we remembered the tax credit bill and thought, well, we could regenerate this to maybe something that would actually work. I think the important thing about this bill is that it puts some parameters around it that when we talk about tax credits and the corners of the mouth go down and the eyes roll back, that maybe might help with that. And I'm not an economist, so, you know, please, if I say something flawed, you know, don't flog me with it, but you can feel free to point it out. This tax credit bill allows for a company to receive a tax credit for up to $50 million of investment in a facility, and 50% of that as a tax credit. When we're talking about a small company, that investment is not going to be returned to them until 3 or 4 years down the road. They've got nothing to apply the tax credit to. So we ask that this tax credit be usable for 5 years for any company that would choose to take advantage of it. Then it's gone. I mean, they are full tax-paying citizens of whatever community that they live in. It is not like a income tax credit. It's not like a real estate tax credit that you can take over and over and over again. It's gone. And so the people that are employed by that facility will pay the taxes into the community in the form of income taxes, the facility will pay increasing tax credits as time goes on. The other thing I think that's important about this tax credit bill is that if the company that's choosing to make the investment already has this investment anywhere in a long-term plan, they cannot request the tax credit because it means that they were thinking that they could make a go of the investment. The tax credit can only be used to improve access in areas where there is not already access, so it can't be used to go in and create competition. And finally, it can only be used by providers who meet minimum performance standards, so we aren't wasting money on providers who cannot actually meet the demand for the service in the rural area. Now, to give you an example of why this is important, I live just outside Wallowa County, and if you've ever been there, you know it's a long place, a long ways, and it's way up the road. We have not succeeded in getting even middle-mile transport to Wallowa County. The investment is very high for the return, and we just issued an RFI to see if we couldn't find some way to work out public-private partnerships or something to make this happen, and we didn't get a very big response. Yet we have a very vibrant community up there of entrepreneurs, Lone Eagles, wonderful foundry industry, and they are unable to market as actively as they would like because to market, they have to put somebody on an airplane and send them out because they don't have the ability to telecommute their product to globally or to the rest of the United States. And I don't know whether you're aware of this, but Valley Bronze provided a lot of the bronze fittings for the World War II Memorial. So we're not talking about little-known businesses. We're talking about some pretty profound entrepreneurs up there. We also have a lot of people who are electing to be Lone Eagles up there and working for some very big corporations throughout the United States and are very, very frustrated with us because we as EOTC are supposed to find that solution, and we haven't been able to. So I'm not saying that the tax credit fixes all of this, but it does offer a piece and a tool for communities who are not being served to incent that investment. And I think it's going to take coupling it with some partnerships and things like that, but it will be something that I think with the increased cap and the increased percentage on it will make it much more interesting to offer providers. So with that, I will quit, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Or maybe we'll just wait and
do the panel.
Do the panel. Mr. Penhallow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Penhallow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. We thank you for the opportunity this morning to appear before you in support of Senate Bill 11. I have a copy of my testimony, hopefully in front of you. Senate Bill 11 was introduced by the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology for the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, as Senator Nelson mentioned in his comments. He indicated that the council was created by House Bill 2577 last session, and my testimony is in conflict with that, and I need to explain why so that hopefully you'll understand. The council was actually created in the 2001 legislative session by Senate Bill 765, which was a priority piece of legislation for the counties of Oregon. Its purpose was to set up a council to look at the development of broadband technology across the state. It was established initially for a two-year period. Senator Nelson is correct. Last session, the work of that council was extended for another 2 years by House Bill 2577. The council is very important, and I would like to point out to you in my testimony really the statutory directive that this council has. The council is directed to study alternative approaches to providing coordinated statewide, regional, and local telecommunications services, including providing services to areas of the state that are underserved or not served at all. The council has also been directed to study the manner in which telecommunications investments can be coordinated to facilitate partnerships between the public sector and the private sector and between the state and local governments. So this bill is is a thrust in that sense of the term, that we feel that we need the assistance of this particular legislation to see that that last mile, as Ms. Britton talked about, can be developed and broadband can be brought to all of our communities across the state. The council has worked in its responsibility in looking at these broadband services. They're, as you know, they are important to business, they're important to government. They're not only just important to information-based kinds of businesses, but across the board, in healthcare, in public safety, in consumer information, and so forth. This particular piece of legislation is important because it encourages telecommunications infrastructure investments that is needed to span the geographic and economic gaps that exist today. And many of our counties are very much aware of that. The ORS 759016 sets out, as you may be aware, the telecommunications policy of the state of Oregon. And again, I would like to read that to you. It is the goal of this state to promote access to broadband services for all Oregonians in order to improve the economy in Oregon, improve the quality of life in Oregon's communities, and reduce the economic gap between Oregon communities that have access to broadband digital applications and services and those that do not, both for both present and future generations. Senate Bill 11 was introduced to make the current advanced telecommunications infrastructure tax credit program more attractive and usable for investors in the telecommunications infrastructure projects. Ms. Britton talked about the limitations that have been written in the bill, and I won't go over that again. It is in my testimony. We think this is a very important piece of legislation, along with other measures that have been recommended by the Telecommunications Council that have been referred to other committees here in the Senate. We think that package of legislation is very important for the future of Oregon. As we see it from the county viewpoint, for the economic development of Oregon communities, and we would certainly encourage you to give this bill favorable consideration and pass it to the Senate with a two-pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Cameron.
Chair Deckert, Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christopher Tamarin with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of the department to support Senate Bill 11 to modify and extend the Advanced Telecommunications Infrastructure Tax Credit Program, and I've provided a written copy of my testimony to the committee. We are aware of the concerns around any legislative proposal with potential impacts on state revenue, yet we support this tax credit program because it's consistent with and advances the goals and policies established by the legislature. To briefly highlight the goals and policies established in the Oregon Revised Statutes, it's the goal of the state to promote access to broadband services for all Oregonians, as Mr. Penhallow has already cited. It's the policy of the state to focus on strategies and investments that maximize the economic benefit to the state of the global shift to an information, science, and technology-driven economy and on industries and companies that make significant use of the high-capacity telecommunications, science and technology-related manufacturing processes, or knowledge transfer typical to these emerging economic sectors. It is the policy of the state of Oregon to encourage and support the rapid deployment of broadband telecommunication services in areas of the state where such services do not exist, to support redundancy of critical telecommunications assets in order to ensure homeland security protections in the state and to ensure that a secure conduit is available for emergency communications and public safety networks in all Oregon communities. And finally, it's recognized that the improvement, expansion, and new construction of the state's infrastructure, those being sewage treatment works, water works, telecommunications infrastructure, roads and public transportation, provide the basic framework for continuing and expanding economic activity in the state, thereby providing jobs and economic opportunity for the people of Oregon. In 2001, the legislature created the Advanced Telecommunications Infrastructure Tax Credit in order to improve advanced telecommunications capability in underserved areas of the state, to enhance individual and business access to advanced telecommunications services at a reasonable cost, to improve access to competitive telecommunications carriers, to improve access by public and private educational institutions, rural health clinics, and libraries to advance telecom services, and to improve telecommunications connections between Oregon communities. And under the program, any infrastructure construction project must meet at least one of the following requirements in order to qualify for the tax credit. It must create or must improve existing advanced telecommunication services in an underserved area with pricing comparable to that for services in the urban areas of Oregon. The facilities must result in the establishment of a new competitive local exchange carrier offering local and long-distance services or a new broadband internet service provider in an underserved area, again, with prices comparable to the urban areas of the state. The facilities must create or improve access for a public or private educational institution, a rural health clinic, or library to advance telecommunication services, again, at competitive costs. The facilities must create at least one diverse telecommunications route where no such diversity existed before, between two or more central offices using SONET or similar technologies to ensure subscribers do not experience loss of service in the event of a fiber cut or network failure. This current program has not been effective. No applications have been received and no tax credits have been granted to date for the Advanced Telecommunications Facilities Tax Credit. The current program will sunset on December 31st of this year. SB 11, as I read it, is intended to make the current tax credit program more attractive and usable and to stimulate new infrastructure projects and pursue the goals that I just outlined. It proposes to increase the tax credit from 20% to 50% of the certified cost of advanced telecommunications facilities, and it also increases the cap on the total annual investment that our department may approve from $10 million to $50 million. And it changes some of the current provisions to make the program more attractive and usable. It allows carriers to apply for the tax credit before placing the advanced facilities in service rather than before any expenditures are incurred, providing the applicant with more time flexibility. It allows the tax credit to be carried forward to the next five succeeding tax years. It allows the transfer of the tax credit, and it extends the program sunset to January 1, 2010. The fiscal impact of this bill varies depending upon assumptions. If tax credits are granted to applicants for projects that would have gone forward with or without the tax credit, the impact will be a net reduction in tax revenue to the state. If tax credits are granted to applicants for projects that would not have gone forward without the tax credit, the impact is going to be a net increase in tax revenue from the resulting operations that otherwise would not exist, in addition to tax revenues from jobs that are created and new economic activity supported by the new infrastructure. So to the extent that the changes proposed in Senate Bill 11 lead to the actual utilization of this incentive, it should result in net benefits to the state through new additional private investment, new infrastructure, new jobs, and increased economic activity. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Mr. Tamarin, I just want to clarify what I understand you said, that no one has actually applied or used any of the tax credits to date.
Chair Deckard, Senator Brzezinski, that is correct.
And then some clarification for me. My understanding, when it was originally being proposed, the previous amount was, I guess, at $40 million, and I know that through some type of reasons it dropped down to 10. Is there a reason for upping it from $40 million, if that's what the original bill called for, to go up to $50
million? The bill was submitted by the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. I think, as you indicated, in current law, the annual cap, that being the total value of projects that the department is authorized to certify for the tax credit, is set at $10 million. I believe it's the intent of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council to increase, you know, the size of the projects or the total number of projects that could receive tax credits under this program.
And if I could here.
Yeah, please.
Regarding what if there's a, I'm going to call it a default, a bankruptcy, or whatever happens for a company that actually got the tax credit, or they just moved, left. Mm-hmm. Is there any payback or requirement that the money that they have deferred mm-hmm. somehow is recovered?
Chair Deckard and Senator Brzezinski, the tax credit is actually administered by the Department of Revenue. The Oregon Economic and Community Development Department's role in the administration is to certify that a project qualifies as a project under the law to receive the tax credit. So the same rules would apply as any other tax credit. And again, it's not a grant per se, but a credit against taxes that would otherwise be due.
So at this point, whatever's in place through the Department of Revenue is what would be applied in this particular tax mm-hmm. credit.
As the same rules as to any other tax credit, correct?
And if I can ask one other question.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
And I think, Mr. Tamarin, this would be for you as well. How many other tax credit or expenditure type of bills that you know of that's going to be coming through or suggested for this committee or the House revenue to look at that would be through the Economic and Community Development Department? Is this the only one that you know that your committee is going to be bringing forward?
Chair Deckard and Senator Brzezinski, to my knowledge, this is the only tax credit proposal that I'm aware of relating to telecommunications facilities and infrastructure. And I'm not aware of other bills that may propose tax credits for economic. There's a bill relating to the e-commerce designated enterprise zones that also involves some tax credit. That's not for infrastructure. I think that's for businesses engaged in e-commerce, locating in e-commerce designated enterprise zones.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the things I want to ask for staff is if we can get a list of any and all tax credit or expenditure type of legislation we may see. As everyone has acknowledged, with the tight budgets that we have, I think it's appropriate for us to know what we may be, let's say, wanting to look at, since we probably are not going to be able to authorize each and every one of them, if any of them.
Yeah, what we'll do, and Mr. Salzgiver, who represents the department, was shaking his head in terms of, I believe there are more. But what we'll do with all the credit bills and incentive bills is we'll probably hear them all at once. We wanted to accommodate this group this morning because the distances that were traveled to be here today from near Joseph. I don't know if Joseph is correct, near LeGrand's. So we wanted to accommodate them on this credit. But what we'll do is we will at least attempt to hear them all at once so that we know the competing interests that are in play for credits. Other questions? Senator George.
Mr. Cameron, in your fiscal impact statement, right in the middle paragraph there, you made a statement that the impact will be a net increase in tax revenue from the resulting operations that otherwise would not have come into existence. Also, we know, people will say, well, you don't have a port, you don't have this, you don't have that. But then all we do is we look to Boise, we look to Salt Lake City, and we realize they don't have a port and they don't have a lot of things, but they have been able to attract major investment into their communities. And I would suppose, and that's my question to you, that a good share of the ability of them to attract is based upon this sort of telecommuting infrastructure.
Chair Deckert and Senator George, I agree. In Oregon statutes, infrastructure includes telecommunications infrastructure. That being, the physical facilities required to support industrial and commercial activity, and as I think certainly today, operating in the information age, any business relies on telecommunications and information technologies, and it is an important part of the state's infrastructure as a whole. It's an important part of any community's infrastructure that impacts its ability to attract new business to its area. It impacts its ability to encourage existing businesses to grow in that area, as well as attracting professionals to move into the area.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, please.
I feel a real moral obligation in this area, and I'll tell you why. The impacts in these rural communities, and I've represented areas including the coast, has been significant because of action by state and federal government. I mean, we've devastated some of these communities with the actions on behalf of the environment and other things like that. I really feel we have a moral obligation to provide some mechanism for those communities to survive. And if this is going to be it, and if it's going to be, for example, what's happened out of Joseph with the foundries that have come in and new kinds of industry, I think we owe it to those communities to help them, since a lot of the harm that has occurred to them has come from actions by government. I guess that's not a question at all, is it?
And if any of y'all want to wade into that, do it at your own risk. Thank you, Senator George. Mr. Tamron, the telecommunication providers are aware of the current program that we have?
Chair Deckert, to the extent that they're familiar with the laws of Oregon, I say yes.
But the department has made an attempt to allow them or let them know that we have what seems to me, and I guess that's my second question, mm-hmm. It seems to me a pretty generous $10 million and 20% of a proposed project seems to be a pretty mm-hmm. generous enticement to me. But the department has marketed this to telecommunications providers to let them know that a program is available, should they...
Chair Deckert, yes, detailed information on the program is available in on the department's website, and to my knowledge, the telecommunications providers of the state are aware that it exists.
The other question that I have is, would it be possible, without expanding it from 20 to 50% and 10 to 50 million, to, on the requirement side, to maybe remove some of the requirements that are in there in terms of they have to improve access to public or private educational institution or rural health clinic or library, and maybe remove some of the requirements, and maybe that would be an enticement to a telecommunication provider. And Mr. Cameron or
Chair Deckard, an applicant for this investment tax credit does not need to meet all of these requirements. They only need to meet one of the other requirements. So it is pretty flexible as it exists today.
Chair Deckard, I think that one of the things that we really wanted this money to be used for was those things that were not currently being provided, and for things that companies would just normally turn away from and say there's no business case for this. And so I think that's what led to the provisions originally in terms of the requirements. When we look at $10 million cap, one facility can cost $10 million. And so maybe there's only one tax credit given in a year. And that was never our intent to do that. So we got, or at least the council got a lot of feedback about that this was not going to really stimulate use. Now, that was back in 2001. We have a lot of new, smaller providers. And as to the question around awareness, we try to put that information out both through economic development and the council. But whether it's widely known by those new providers, I actually can't tell you that.
Hmm. Providers, I see a few. And a nod of the head is sufficient. Do you feel your companies know, well aware, as the nodding heads, well aware of the program? Further questions or comments? Yes, Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the only other, question I would have regarding who makes the determination whether a company was actually planning on working a project and, let's say, building out their own infrastructure as compared to one that was saying, now that we've got this tax credit, we're willing to go there. I mean, who's going to actually do the check and balance as compared to someone saying, hey, now we can get this tax credit and we'll just go ahead and resubmit it? I'm just trying to see how viable that type of provision is and who's actually reviewing that type of stuff. Is there some type of documentation, affidavit that has to be signed by the company, or how's that work?
Chair Deckard and Senator Pozanski, yes, there's an application process, and it's the responsibility of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to certify a project as meeting the conditions for receiving the tax credit. And the applicant does submit a detailed application that describes the project and describes how that project meets and satisfies the conditions of the tax credit.
If I can follow, so if the application, does it state, has this already been contemplated by the company? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how that portion is actually verified. Do you actually have the company saying some type of in the affirmative that they were not looking at doing this? I'm just trying to figure out what the application has on it.
Chair Deckard and Senator Pozanski, as the law currently exists, the application requires that the applicant had not even expended any resources on the project, that it is a proposed project. It's not a project that's in process or currently under construction. The Senate Bill 11 introduces a little more flexibility in that the applicant can now submit for the tax credit before facilities are placed in service, rather than before any expenditures are made on the project at all.
Okay, thank you.
Senator George.
It is the policy of the state of Oregon to encourage and support the rapid deployment of broadband communications. That's, you know, that's where we are. Mm-hmm. Are we doing that? And would it be smart for us to come back to a company that has, say, laid out a plan, here's what we'd like to do in the future, and now that we've committed the act of even thinking about it, we're excluded from this, if I understand what you said, would it be smart for us to go back and say, well, look, if it's not financially feasible at this time, but yet very much beneficial to that community or that region, let's go ahead and allow them to come back in and apply for a credit also in order to get that rapidly deployed. Do you think that's a legitimate process, or where are we in relationship to that concept?
Chair Deckard, Senator George, I would say that the state of Oregon has made tremendous strides in the deployment of broadband technologies throughout the state in recent years as a result of the SB 622 projects, as well as significant investments that have been made by telecommunications service providers in deploying broadband technologies throughout their networks, not just the large telephone companies, but the independent telephone companies and cooperatives. The cable television companies have been upgrading their networks to provide two-way data communications. Multiple broadband wireless service providers have been introducing new networks, upgrading their networks. Mobile wireless telecommunication providers have been upgrading their networks. Again, the state has made tremendous strides over the past 3 years, and our position is much, much stronger than it was just a few short years ago. Again, as the program exists and as it's proposed under Senate Bill 11, any particular carrier is not excluded from applying for it. The evaluation criteria and the nature of the project are what defines, you know, whether the tax credit would be granted or not. So any telecommunications provider could submit a project to be approved for a tax credit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything parting comments?
Chair Deckard, we thank you for the opportunity. We're very anxious to provide any additional information that you might require to just work with you on this in however you might find it helpful. I agree totally with Senator George that we need the deployment out to our rural last mile, and if our working with you can help do that, then so be it. Thank you.
Chair Deckard, I might make a final comment that though we have made significant progress in the state and hopefully we'll utilize that new infrastructure and capitalize on it, all infrastructure is always a work in progress, and I think the intent of the bill here is to continue to put incentives on the table that promotes and facilitates and encourages additional investment in telecommunications infrastructure in the state in the future.
Thank you. Appreciate all the work that y'all have put forth on this effort and the work that your committee has done in the interim. You won't see your bill back up before this committee for quite a time because BSTN, we're one of the committees that stays open late into the session, and credit decisions are usually ones both on the incentive side and credit side, and there are many from more than just the department and individual legislators, and so we will deal with those usually towards the end because they have to be reflected in the budget. But we wanted to absolutely get you in while you're here, and feel free to talk with us in the coming months.
Thank you.
Close the anyone else on Senate Bill 11? Mr. Hughes, are you close the public hearing on Senate Bill 11, and we are going to finish our orientation with the corporate income tax. And Lizbeth is the legislative revenue staff handles what's left of the corporate.
That's a bad indication.
I know.
Let's stop the court, please.
It's just out
of the blue.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with Legislative Revenue Office. So today I'm just going to try to do as best we can to get through these slides. And what you also have in front of you is Department of Revenue's Corp, Excise, and Income Tax book, which is a really good resource for you. It's not as thick as that personal income tax one, so you'll probably be happy about that, and the table's a little easier to read. So I'm going to go through, though, some slides and stuff that are basically from our basic facts, too. So there are some slides that you'll see there if you go through that bestseller of ours. So with the corporate excise taxes, and I will go through a few other business taxes. To begin with, Paul brought you this, too, I think last week, or at least discussed it again. With corporate excise taxes, it's kind of interesting at least to look at those estimated payments that are coming in from corporations. And they make estimated payments. It's, again, when we're talking about the corporate excise tax, we're talking about the big corporations in the state. The C corporations are what we're tracking as far as the corporate income taxes that are coming in. So basically, they have to corporations have to have a nexus here in Oregon in order to pay taxes. And nexus really means any type of a connection. And nexus really determines that degree of connection, of business activity that there really is in the state in order to have a presence, in order to be able to tax them. So basically with this slide here, which we saw on the personal income tax side, is basically the estimated payments from 1999 as your base of the index. And then going forward to the last month here is December of 2004. Again, it's a year period of estimated payments, and it's going back 12 months from the month that you're seeing here as a data point, with January of 1999 being your reference year. Then you've got here the black solid line is all industries together. And so, again, you can see there right around about February of 2001, we started to see a decline here in all sectors. And that really does mirror then this green line here is manufacturing. And prior to our recession, manufacturing was, you know, really the largest industry that was bringing in corp estimated payments. So what you saw here at this big line before about April of 2001, manufacturing had, you know, increased twofold. You can see there with the index being 2.5 from just January of 1999. And then now it's just been falling. And so, you know, it fell significantly due to the 2001 recession all the way until about March of 2003. And then we saw some increasing and some regaining then, and even went above the level it was at in January of 1999. But now what we saw recently is that, you know, again, these are estimated payments the corporations are making. So they're just looking at their prior year and what kind of changes they may have been seeing. But they overestimated, a few companies overestimated here. So at the end of the year, we saw some big refunds go out. So that's why then you're seeing these big drops. And that's what makes for the hard difficulty in really projecting corporate excise tax is because of the, you get in these estimated payments, you think it's in, but you always got to worry about what could be the refunds at the end of the year or, you know, at the time that they're going to rectify their tax liability. And so that's the kind of thing that you can see, and that's what adds to the volatility in this stream. And you got to remember that corporations get penalized if they do not pay enough in taxes. So there's a real incentive to make sure you're paying enough because they don't want to have to pay penalties. So basically what you see here, the industries you know, basically we're struggling during the 2001 session of manufacturing. You also see here red is information. The information sector was really having trouble and dropped quite a bit. But you see things like finance, insurance. Well, this did drop from, you know, this index went below one. But then you can see here in recent months, this has been taking off again. All throughout 2004, finance and insurance has been doing just fine. So, again, that's the same sector that we saw on the personal income tax side doing well. You see it also in the corporate tax side. And also up here, retail trade has done a lot better, and that tells you that there's a lot more going on, that those you see a lot more multinational corporations that are involved in things like retail trade, which then helps stabilize. Because even if Oregon's retail trade may be declining, like we saw on the personal income tax side, you can see the corp is still doing, you know, at least it's above the level it was at in January of 1999. So those are the kind of effects that you'll see. It's some much more of the, you got to look at the components of the corporate excise tax, and whether there's a lot of multinational corporations in there, then that will maybe have some effect on you, on the state of Oregon, as far as the amount of corporate excise taxes we receive.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Can you give us an example of management of companies, what type of corporations those are?
Chairman Decker and Senator Brzezinski, that's holding companies.
Holding companies.
Yeah, so, and there's very few of them. So really recognize that's only reflecting less than 50, you know, corporations. So,
okay.
You know, some of these sectors are real small, and that's one of them.
Thank you.
Okay, now to just kind of give you a little bit of kind of reflection on how our businesses have been kind of changing, and this really kind of shows you the number of returns here between 1990 and 2002. And I just use these particular four groups just because it is kind of representative of some of the things that you'll think of as businesses, and it's easy data for me to get. So we can look at sole proprietors, which again are single. Single individuals who have their own business, they are not sheltered by liability. They have to absorb any liability that their business absorbs. So if they basically pay the personal income tax alone, they do not pay any type of a corporate tax. And then you've got like S corporations, which are a corporate entity. So the corporation is the one that is segmented to the liability from any changes in the gains or losses from the business. But then what you see is they pass through all of their profits to their shareholders in the S corporations. But S corporations have to be small. They recently in federal law they increased the number of shareholders to 100. But still, that's one of the big limitations with S corporations is they can't be real large. And farms. This is the farm number of farm returns that we see, and this just really farms can many times be like LLCs, limited liability corporations, or other types of small businesses, or sole proprietors and stuff. But what we're able to capture here is the amount of income on the personal income tax return, and so that's where we can capture the number of farms and how many returns have farm income. And then the C corporations, this is the number of returns that are then the big corporations that are paying our excise corporate tax. So what you see over time here, since 1990, the number of C corporations really has just dropped slightly. It dropped 1%. But as far as the number of big corporations in the state, it hasn't been changing much over the past 12 years. As far as the portion of the total, it's gone down. It went from 13% to 11%. But what we see are the small corporations, the S corporations, they grew significantly as far as the number of returns. So this grew 148% to now 45,728. We now have more S corporations in the state than we have C corporations. And that's happened over the last 12 years. So as far as the portion of the total S corporations went from 7% on up to 13.7%. And sole proprietors are still the largest number. They're the easiest way in which to start a business. So you'll see that still is a growing type of business. It's roughly grew at 12% between 1990 and 2002. But the portion of the total fell a little bit from 67% to 64%. Now when we look at the same thing, these same businesses types, but we're looking at the amount of income that is actually being generated from these business types in 1990 versus 2002, what we see is the great growth here in the C corporations as far as the amount of income that they actually are earning. This is by far the fastest income growth earning group, it grew roughly 10% a year. It grew 123% over this 12-year period. So as far as our portion of our total business income now, in 1990 it was 44% C-Corps. Now it's 61% C-Corps. And farms have really just their income continues to decline. As corporations, you see an increase, obviously, in the amount of income because the number of returns has increased so significantly, but it's not at the same rate. The income growth is not at the same rate as what we see in the number of returns. So S Corporation's portion of the total grew from 15% to 17% of all business income, but it hasn't grown half as fast. And sole proprietors saw an increase, but it was only about 8% a year. And that so their portion of the total fell from 40% down to 24%. But this just kind of gives you an idea of kind of the changes that are going on amongst businesses as far as business types. And you've been hearing it when you hear about, you know, the small businesses being the engine of growth and stuff for the state. And that's what's reflected in these S corporations. And you see that also with the limited liability corporations and partnerships, which I haven't included in here, but those have also been growing significantly. Now, to just kind of go through a real basic business income tax statement, and this is similar to what we did on the personal income tax side. Again, these big corporations are taxed on their net earnings. So what happens is that they first are going to be filing a federal tax return, and if they are a member of a larger group of corporations, then all of those different sales from those different corporations will be consolidated and all reported on the federal return. So what you start with are gross sales. So these are the sales from all business operations. And then you're going to minus off the amount of cost of goods that are sold then. And then that'll equal your gross profit. And again, this is for all the corporations within a consolidated group that all have a business activity that's the same. And then what you do from the gross profit, you'll also add in then other income components, and that can be dividends that different companies received, interest, gross rents, gross royalties, capital gains, net capital gains and losses. So then you'll come up with your total income. And then from there, you'll minus off things like these are the federal deductions. And these are things, again, Oregon is connected with corporate taxable income at the federal level. So that's the connection. Again, just like we're connected with the federal definition of taxable income for personal, we're also connected with corporate. So what we encompass there are all of these federal deductions. Okay, so all those federal deductions we're going to bring forward in our bottom line here in, on our corporate excise tax return. So these are all the payroll costs, interest, rent, depreciation, repairs and maintenance, bad debt, licenses, charitable contributions. So there's a whole host of them. Now those are things that on the in the personal income tax statistics book, you can get that kind of data, but we don't really have that in the green book that I just gave you on the corporate side. So if that's something you're interested in, I mean, we can go through and list all those for you from the federal return. But basically, from all those deductions, then you end up with a net business income, and that's before any net operating losses or deductions or any special deductions for dividends. So then this is basically the starting point then in Oregon with our Oregon excise tax return. We're going to look at our federal taxable income before net deductions and before the deduction for dividends. So then what we do here in Oregon, just like on our personal income tax side, Oregon has additions. So this is Oregon income that we basically are saying we want to tax, but the federal government does not. So that's, and actually even one of the major ones is interest earned on all state and municipal bonds, which is the same addition that we had on the personal income tax side. And then we have subtractions, and the biggest subtraction there, and these are ones that these are the things that the federal government does tax, but Oregon does not. And in addition to that, not to make that big generalization, is the dividend deduction. And at the federal level, there is a dividend deduction, but we have our own adjustments to that federal dividend deduction, so that's why we have it separated out And so basically that dividend deduction is our largest one. So you, basically what you think of it as a dividend in terms of a corporation will be able to deduct for those dividends that they actually paid to either another corporation or to their own employees. So at the corporate entity level, they do not have to pay the dividends. It's the dividends pay tax when they are received by the particular personal income tax holders through the personal income tax system. Other deductions are things like charitable contributions, land donated or bargain sales of land to educational institutions, dividends from the foreign sales corporations. And then you also have to look at the net operating loss and net capital loss deduction. Now, this is one where we have disconnected slightly from federal in terms of the amount of carry forward that we are allowing here. So in Oregon, we allow a 15-year carry forward for this deduction. And for so everyone's clear, what a carry forward means is in a given year, if you had, you know, say $1 million in net operating losses, you could only take, because due to the amount of federal taxable income, so you could only take, you know, half of that, 500,000. Then you would have 500,000 left. And then the next year, in 2005 or 2006, you could take 500,000 plus any other net operating losses that you had. So we allow a carry forward of these losses and things for 15 years here in Oregon. At the federal level, they're allowed 20 years carry forward. And as well, at the federal level, they're also allowed to carry back. So you could go and revise federal returns that had already been paid from prior years in order to use those net operating losses. We do not allow that here in Oregon, no carry back. We just allow carry forwards for 15 years. So there are ways in which Oregon has disconnected with the federal law, and this is kind of in one area. So, you know, there is a plenty of precedents where we have been making different policy changes than what's happening at the federal level. But recognize we are connected with all those federal tax deductions. We are connected with our corporate taxable income. We just have these various additions and subtractions. So then we come up with an Oregon taxable income. Okay, so now this becomes the important part for Oregon. And what one thing I haven't brought in here yet, but if we get to it, is the apportionment portion. So what you then look at is what portion of this federal taxable income is actually income that's here in Oregon. Okay, it has to have a payroll. It has to have a property. It has to have some sales. There's got to be some recognition of presence here in Oregon through either the payroll, property, or...
And what are our phase and dates on that?
Chairman Deckard, it is on one of the slides coming up.
It is.
But I think we'll get to it. But, yeah, it's 2000. We're now at 80% sales. And in 2006, it changes again to 90.
First.
Yeah, it's July 1st, correct.
July 1st, 2006.
Correct. Right.
Just to 90.
Correct. Yeah, and so then after you basically are apportioned income to Oregon, then we have Oregon's taxable income. And then we look at then our tax rate of 6.6 being applied uniformly. Again, there's no tiered at all tax here in Oregon. It's just one tax rate. And then we end up with our Oregon tax before credit. So this graph here just tries to give you a little bit of understanding of where our 6.6 rate of for corporations kind of fits in the whole scheme of other states that have a corporate tax. And in 2004, what we see is Oregon was basically, this is ranked 30th from the top here of states that had a corporate excise tax. So 6.6 is, you know, a bit lower than some states. But again, just recognize all I did here was look at the tax rates. There's a whole, this is not tax burden by any means on businesses. What this shows you, though, is also is this star here by certain states means that there are 10 different states that have tiered or multi-tiered corporate tax structure. And what I have included here is the top tax rate for each one of those states. So let's say like Iowa here, which is at the top, and I put 12% as their rate. Well, that's their top rate. They've got a tiered rate from 6% to 12%. So just so everyone's clear, there's really only 38 states out of these 48 that are listed there that have a flat tax. 10 of them have a tiered tax. Now, this just kind of gives you a little bit of an understanding here. I went and took the trends since 1990 to 2002 of Oregon corporate credits that are used. And the important point to recognize here is Oregon corporate credits that are actually used really fluctuate according to the amount of profits, amount of tax liability that the corporations have. And that's what this graph shows you, because the burgundy bars here are the total credits that are used. And you can see it's from about $17 million here in 1991 versus in 1999 of about $43 million. So it can fluctuate quite a bit. But it's kind of interesting that in 1990 it was $22 million, and then in 2002 we're still at $22 million 12 years later. So, you know, it fluctuates really according to how much tax liability corporations have. And that's what this blue line here is. I've given you the base tax for corporations before any credits are applied. And you can see, the credits dropped between 1990 and 91, and this dropped slightly. And then once you start seeing an increase here, 1991 on up to 1994, the total credits grew significantly. Well, so did the amount of base tax that they were paid. And then it started to fall here between 1994 and 95. And then you'll see here that it pretty much when there's declines in the base tax, there's declines in total credits. But what you also will see in just a minute is really this is, even though this is tax credits used, the amount that is unused is kind of flip. So as you can't use as many, then you're going to see more unused credits. Now here just shows you some of the trends then in C corporations as far as the amount that were utilized between 1998 and 2002. And these are some of our big credits that most of you are familiar with. The research and development credit. What you see here in the amount used is it grew pretty significantly in 1999 and then in 2000, and then it's fallen in recent years. So, it got to be almost $10 million there as far as the amount that was used. But that's because they had tax liability then. Okay, and then it fell again in 2001 and 2 because the corporate taxes fell so significantly. So there wasn't the tax liability to be able to use as much. And the same is true with pollution control. We had pollution control in 1999 when there was a lot of tax liability, was well over $12 million. And then it fell significantly till now in 2002. It's a little over $7 million.
And what's the status of our pollution control tax credit?
Senator Deckard, in what way?
I remember the legislation that was brokered, I believe, in... I want to say, what was Governor Kitzhaber's final funds in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Can you refresh us on the agreement that was reached on the pollution control in that 2001 legislation?
Chairman Deckard, well, really with pollution control, it's like the maximum amount is like 35% of the pollution control cost of the investment and things. But that is a sliding scale depending on the type of investment that you're making. But there is a sunset on the credit, too, pollution control. I think it's 2008.
It's sunset.
Yeah. Sunset. And again, as we've talked about, Chairman Deckard, I know you know this, but so everyone's clear, on something like pollution control, you don't take it all in one year, okay? So just because you may sunset it on a certain year, it would still go on for at least 10 years afterwards because they take it over a 10-year period.
Very cool.
Yeah, so you've already committed to a certain number of facilities being allowed this credit, and then you've got to see that credit through until it ends. So with the low-income housing, basically with this, these are the credits that are designed to assist the lenders for their portion of the low-interest loans that they're making and things. And each year, this is not really low-income housing. It didn't hit quite $4 million yet, but this was only 24 different corporations that actually took this in 2002. So there's not a whole lot of people. The number of corporations that are affected the most is by research and pollution control. And energy conservation, too, which is the business energy one, that affects quite a few people, too. And 204 corporations that actually claimed the credit in 2002. So energy conservation has been growing, and I think that's true just because you can do small projects with energy conservation and more people can use it then. So I think you're hitting a larger number of businesses that way. And then this dependent care assistance hasn't changed too much. It's fallen a little bit, but it's not a large portion of our total credits. This gives you just the breakdown of those credits by percentages. You can see here pollution control in 2002, there was 22.5 million. This pollution control was 32% of that 22.5 million, or about 7.1 million. Then you had like business and energy credits, and that's 17%. This again is 35% of the cost of certified cost of the project. It's taken over 5 years, and this needs to be approved by the Department of Energy, where pollution control is approved by DEQ. Research and development is another bigger one. That's about 14% of the total. So, you know, if you added up the low-income housing at 16% and then research, you know, so then you're up to 30 and then 47 with business energy. So, you know, you've got over 68% here in just these four credits. You know, 68% of all the credits used of this $22 million in just these four right here. So you can see it's quite concentrated. And the other credits, you have things like the insurance credits. There was a farm machinery and equipment credit for corporations. It's pretty small, but that's in there. Oregon Cultural Trust, that's in the others credit. So basically, one thing I wanted to kind of bring forward, because it's something we don't always look at, but it's the amount of unused credits that there are for corporations. And again, as I was saying, as corporate tax liability goes down, the amount of credit they can actually use goes down, and then the amount of unused goes up. So what we see here in recent years due to the recession here, and that's the red and the yellow here at the end in 2001-02, there is $40 million in unused credits total for the state. So that's twice as many unused credits as there were in credits that were actually used. So, and again, we have some carry forward provisions in most all of these credits. Research, it's 5 years. Pollution control, it's 3 years. Low income housing, 5 years. So, you know, most of them have some provisions, but recognize that this is how you get these total unused credits is because if you don't use it all for 1 year, then it kind of builds on itself to the point now where, like, we have 40 million, you know, twice as many unused credits as you have credits. And most of that, as you can see here, is research and development. So, and as we know from last session, we did have an expansion of the R&D credit that will be coming on in 2006. So this is 2002, and we have this amount of unused credit. So recognize this, you know, amount of unused R&D is bound to grow because we expanded the base. So the number of corporations that actually can be taking the R&D will probably grow, as well as we increase that percentage. You know, that maximum amount of the credit that could be taken by each corporation was 500,000, or that's how much it was in 2002, and then it's going up to 750,000. That's a change you made last session. So basically with research, what we saw in 2002 were 153 companies actually claimed the credit, but only 67 had a reduction in tax. Okay, so that tells you there were almost 100 corporations out here with unused credits. So that's just because they didn't have enough tax liability in 2002. So in 2003 and 2004, when they have more tax liability coming out of the recession, they'll use more of their research and development.
Paul.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of relate what Elizabeth's talking about with the Senate Bill 11 you heard, one of the provisions of current law for the telecommunications credit is that it may not be carried forward. So that would be part of Senate Bill 11, would make it into a credit that could be carried forward for 5 years And I think that, I don't know if that came out in the testimony, but that would be a, one of the significant changes in Senate Bill 11. And so when you have those years where you have no liability, particularly in a recession year, you can't carry it forward, then you essentially lose the value of that credit.
And you can accumulate as you go, up until what it's on, that, so that bill is an example. It sunsets in 2005, so you could accumulate as, carry forward as you go, year by year, tax liability by liability.
Yeah, Chairman Deckard, and you would take your oldest credit year first, you know, when you want to apply. So, you can take, say you got 3 years of credit, you know, backing up. You would take your third year first, then your second year, and things like that. So what you saw in Senate Bill 11 was a five-year carry forward. Yeah. And that's pretty common. I mean, that's, like I was saying, research and development is 5 years. Low-income housing is 5 years.
Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair.
Senator George and Senator Prezanski.
You know, a lot of focus on this issue and as to, you know, the tax expenditure tables and all of the tax credits. Would it even be technically or legally possible to go back with the person who has accumulated or has carried forward, you know, the deductibility of these credits and then take those away? Would that be even possible?
Chairman Deckard and Senator George, no. Okay. I mean, you've got an obligation. Once you certify a facility, you've got an obligation to give them that credit for that many years that you're allowed, like a pollution control, 10 years. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. That's a good point in terms of what we've already
today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Basically today forward.
Yeah, we've rolled it. Yeah, exactly.
And everything's locked in. Yeah, that's a good point. Senator Prezanski.
Thank you. If it expires in 5 years, am I hearing it that at the conclusion of that 5 years, they could not carry it any further? So if for whatever reason their company wasn't doing quite as well and they carried over 2 years, at the end of that fifth year, they'd have to use it or lose it.
Senator Prezanski, that's correct. And there are, you know, corporations can talk about credits that just got burned because they just couldn't use them over 5 years. So.
And then one other thing, yeah. There was a part in Senate Bill 11 that said that those credits would be transferable. I'm assuming that meant if a company took over for the original company that made the investment as compared to transferring whatever credit I have to someone else that doesn't have that holding or that.
Senator Prezanski, yeah, and I don't know exactly what would be all the provisions around that because we haven't seen a whole lot of that yet. Last session, though, we had a bill, Farm Worker Housing, I think it's the one that allowed the transferring then of credits. And one of the things they came in and said was some of these are nonprofit organizations that are actually putting these farm worker housing complexes into place, and they're not the ones that have tax liability. So they want to be able to transfer that. So, there can be some of that going on where the entity that actually is putting, the facilities in place and incurring all the costs may not be able to use the credits. So then they can market them and
be able outright to market them to, let's say, an open market, or to would it be closed within their other corporate structure?
Senator Prezanski, I think it's, you know, within a group. I don't remember the details of that, and that's something that housing, if you were looking at other, credits that were transferred, you could get some clarification from them as far as how they're handling it, because we haven't really discussed that much because it just got put into place.
If I could just...
Yeah, please.
I guess the reason I bring this up is I've heard of companies that, like, have pollution credits that they can't use, and they actually put them out on what I'm going to call the open market for others that have, just say, used all they could, but they want to buy them. And I'm wondering if we're dealing with that type of level or if it's more close-knit within, you know, that corporate entity, knowing that there could be a nonprofit versus a profit side.
Senator Prezanski, I don't know of any other selling of credits like that. I mean, I don't see how the Department of Revenue could ever, you know, they've got to be able to track who has liability for those credits, and that's why there was even a provision in your Senate Bill 11 to say they had to inform the Department of Revenue of who's buying this tax credit. So they've got to be able to audit these tax credits. Mm-hmm. They can't just be, going out there and being sold. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, my understanding is at the federal level, you see more marketing of tax credits.
Yeah, maybe at the federal level.
Yeah. That's what I was just wondering. Yeah. We have that here. It doesn't sound like.
Yeah.
Well, we do. I mean, I've talked to companies here, but it just doesn't seem that there's a great deal of activity. I mean, folks will come and talk to you about their tax credit and perhaps being able to market it, mm-hmm. but then they don't seem to have too much of a game plan in place of how they're going to achieve that is what I found when I'm talking to folks about marketing their Oregon tax credits.
Well, part of the reason, Mr. Chair, maybe that we've got 40 million unused credits.
Blood on the market.
A fire sale on tax credits. Maybe we can hear that for you Tuesday.
The blue light special.
That's a good way to... We'll market them.
Okay, well, just to kind of hit some of the highlights of the corporate excise tax, just to everyone's clear, we have a unitary reporting requirement, and this was adopted in 1984. So basically, with the unitary group, what we're saying is that, you know, all the corporations or groups of corporations that are engaging in business activities together in order to constitute one single trade or one single business, then they're going to have to file together. So we kind of eliminate that separate legal existence of all these various corporations. If they're working together under one umbrella business group, one umbrella trade, then they've got to report together. And then that's what happens at the federal level. You have a consolidated tax return that's filed at the federal level for all those various activities and all those companies that are integrated together. And then here in Oregon, what happens is we have the income that is for the state of Oregon, that is a portion then to Oregon, and that's just our business income here in Oregon, and that just is the income that is attributed to the particular business. What we have also with corporations is, like I was talking about, the S corporations has their income passed through to the personal income tax, and they pay their dividends through the personal income tax. They do. They're just a really small amount of corporate S corporate income that would actually be paid at the corporate level. What they pay is the minimum tax. Okay, and as most of you know, the minimum tax in corporations is $10. Been in place since 1931. It was a large component of Measure 30, and we've had all those discussions. But just so everyone's clear, if you do have any changes that you're interested in the corporate minimum, that's the kind of thing that I can do for you. I've got, you know, various different spreadsheets to kind of model that kind of thing.
I've heard statistics are, I guess, anecdotal on how many we had that paid the minimum of $10.
Yeah.
I know it's proprietary. Do you know the number?
Chairman Deckard, yeah. If we can just jump here ahead to, this is your slide 16, which is a couple pages in there, but that's not bad. Here, this is the slide of the number of C and S corporations paying the minimum tax. And this is also the C corporation's percent of all corporations paying that minimum tax. And this goes from 1990 to 2002. And so your striped bars here are the number of S corporations. And again, as we talked about, since 1990, the number of S corporations has grown larger than the number of C corporations. So obviously the amount of minimum tax that's paid by S corporation is larger than the amount of minimum tax paid by C corporations. Now, the number of C corporations has been growing, though. You can see since about 1994, the percent of the total corporations that are C corporations has grown now to about 68% of all C corporations by 2002. So that's kind of the statistic that you'll hear around, is 68% of all corporations are paying the minimum tax of C corporations. Now, this is just kind of a good slide to just kind of remind everyone, since we're kind of out of time, but just of the amount of tax that is paid by corporations, let's look at just the top 50 corporate taxpayers and what percent of the tax do they pay. And as you look here, the top 10 paid $51.8 million of that, as we were talking before, of the total amount of tax of $229 million. Basically, that's 22.5% of all tax is paid by just 10 corporations in the state. And then you add another 10, so you look at the top 20, you've got 31% of all the tax paid. It's roughly $72 million altogether. Now you look at the top 30 corporations, then you're up to 38% of the total tax. And then you're up to about $86 million. And then you add up to another 10 and you get the top 40, you get 42% of all the tax until you hit the top 50 and you're roughly at $105.9 million of tax. That is 46% of all the $229 million that was paid in 2002. So, you know, this should give you a better understanding of why corporate, you know, taxes in Oregon is so volatile, because, you know, you really have almost 50 taxpayers, you know, 50 corporations paying almost 50% of the tax. So that's what makes it so difficult also to model for the state forecaster. So the rest of it is just basically a breakdown of the corporate net tax, which I've just, you know, basically gone through. But, you know, this shows it, too, as far as the multi-state versus Oregon only. And what you see here, as far as the percent of the tax, it's primarily multi-state corporations. And so you've got almost 80% there, multi-state corporations versus 20% Oregon only. And so when you're looking at, and this is the slide that Senator Deckert was talking about with the changes from the multi-state corporate apportionment formula. And again, the corporate apportionment formula just is trying to allocate the amount of business activity that's here in Oregon by sales, by payroll, and property. And so what we have now here in 2003 from House Bill 2281 in the 2001 session is an 80% sales and a 20% payroll and property. And then in 2006, due to House Bill 3183, we'll move up to 90% sales and 10% payroll impact. Payroll and property in July 1st, and then 2008 and beyond is when we hit the 100%. So basically that's, you know, it as far as this rest of it just kind of goes through the different multi-state corporate apportionment formulas, and what we're seeing here is Oregon is one of these, a hybrid between 50% and 90% sales, and there's five other states that basically are at that same level. And there's only seven states that use 100% sales, but I will quantify that to say also that the three of these states also have another type of apportionment formula for certain industries. So that's what we're seeing as far as the trend among states, is not only are we moving towards a heavier weighted sales in our corporate apportionment formula, but also we're seeing some divisions among industries. So different states will allow different industries to have different corporate apportionment formulas. And here in Oregon, we just have telecommunications and in utilities that actually have their own different corporate apportionment formula. But basically, that's about it. This just gives you your breakdown by states of what their corporate apportionment formula is. And then this is just an example. And then the last point is just recognizing that here in Oregon, we have an Oregon sales throwback rule, which basically says depending on where the sales originate. So if the sales originate in the state of Oregon, what happens is if they go to a state which doesn't tax them and the purchaser basically is not taxing them, then what happens is they can get thrown back to the state of Oregon, to the state in which they originated. And so for Oregon, we had in 2002 $2.85 billion in sales. That basically, if Oregon hadn't taxed them, they wouldn't have had any tax placed on that income. So they were thrown back to Oregon, and then that generated $27.5 million in additional corp revenue. And as you can see here, this shows you the breakdown by industry groups. It was mainly manufacturing. 38% of that was manufacturing, 26% wholesale trade. So those are the two big sectors.
Senator Jarvis. Mm-hmm.
That $2.85 billion is money earned someplace else that we tax? Did I understand that correctly? Or?
Senator George, the product had to originate in Oregon.
Oh, okay.
So, okay, it had to be been either made here, shipped from here. Oregon had to have been involved as far as originating state for those sales. But then they went somewhere. Usually you're taxing the sales in the state in which they're received.
Mm-hmm.
So when we see our sales factor here in Oregon, it's all the sales that were, you know, purchased here in Oregon by Oregon residents, by Oregon companies. Okay, so that's what our sales factor means. So, but what you have in a throwback rule is that if those sales are not taxed somewhere else, because either there wasn't tax in that other state or the federal government, then you can throw them back to the state in which they came from. And this is pretty common. There's quite a few states. I think in 2002, 26 states had this Oregon, had a throwback rule. And just one other point to make it clear, that's I had an example on this on the House side that made this clear. But basically, also, you have to, the state that is receiving those sales has to have some nexus with that corporation. So there has to be nexus established in the state which is receiving the sales. And then they get thrown back
to
the
original. So, for example.
Okay, so you say, like, you're a tea company here in Oregon, and you're going to send teas to Washington residents in Washington State. Washington State doesn't have a tax. So those sales, if you have, say, like, a personnel there to receive the shipments, and then it's gone out to Oregon, gone out to Washington residents, there's establishment then of nexus in the state of Washington because you have personnel there in the state of Washington also. So, since you have a nexus in that receiving state and that state is not taxing, then they can get thrown back to the state of Oregon and they become part of our sales base, our sales income. Okay, as the chairman said, that's it.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Elizabeth? Thank you. That concludes our day today. We have a full week next week debating committee, and I welcome your input in terms of start time. We could continue with the 9 o'clock start time. At some point, we're going to need to go to 8:30. But we could continue, I believe, next week with 9. I'm open either way. Tuesday, the first, we start in on the whole compliance collections, which would keep us busy. So if y'all have thoughts,
yep.
Like at 8:30?
Oh, no. I was thinking about the compliance collection people that we got for that.
On Tuesday, yeah.
I think we should stay with 9 through next week and look at it week by week.
Okay.
As long as we don't have a load in moving our session back.
Yeah, it's 10:45, and this was longer. Okay, so we'll continue to go with 9 next week, and then, as Vice Chair Starr mentioned, we'll take a look at it on Thursday, whether we bump it back to 8:30. At some point, we will need to go to 8:30. And also, in that same behavior modification, I am now building into my breakfast Senator Starr's bread, and mm-hmm. so it's now part of my routine I found this morning of lighter breakfast and bread. But if folks want to avail themselves to, we have a very thoughtful Senator Starr who provides bread mm-hmm. for us in the morning. I don't know if I was supposed to offer to him.
Well, I need to get him making hazelnut.
Glad to do that. You just provide the hazelnuts. I've used walnuts because I have them. But
from California, right?
Yeah, from California. Well, this is economic development. Community.
They won't get caught up in our throwback sales then. All right, we are adjourned. Have a great, safe weekend.